I am Plant on the Line in Vancouver at thecommentary.ca. Journey with No Maps is the critically acclaimed biography of P.K. Page, the Canadian poet and fine artist. It was published last year, and it was announced recently, a finalist for the upcoming Governor General Literary Award for Nonfiction. It was also a finalist for the 2013 Charles Taylor Prize. The book's author, Sandra Joie, joins me now to talk about this book, as well as P.K. Page. Page's impact on Canadian poetry and art made her one of the most influential and beloved figures in Canadian arts and letters. Sandra Joie is a biographer and critic, having published acclaimed biographies of F.R. Scott and Roy Daniels. She is a professor emerita in the Department of English at Simon Fraser University. She first met Page in 1970 and was asked by Page to write her biography. This book is published by McGill Queen's University Press. Please welcome to the Plant on the Line program, Sandra Joie. Professor Joie, good morning.
Good morning.
Thanks for joining us.
Pleased to be here.
So, were you friends with Page?
Oh, that's always such a difficult question for a biographer. Yes, we were. We were at first acquaintances, and then we became friends. And then I became her biographer. Biographers can't be close friends. Close friends support you no matter what. Biographers have to point out the pros and cons.
And would you do that to her? Like, I mean, if you were hanging
yes,
out?
Yes, when we discussed various things. We didn't discuss everything by any means, because much was written after her death. But she might sometimes say something, and then I would have to say, but P.K., you weren't in London when Mackenzie King was there. Or I would have a different reading of that poem, and so on.
And you called her P.K., right?
I did. I called her Pat in the 70s. I don't know why, but in the 70s she was Pat. But after the 70s she became P.K., a literary. That was the way she was known in the literary world.
And in your work at SFU, teaching in the English department there, did you find that you were using her work, her material, a lot?
Well, no more than the other good poets, uh-huh. No more than Atwood. And I was also very fond of Jay McPherson and Margaret Avison and as well as Scott, Pratt, the major male poets. I taught them all.
Yeah, no, you described her as a good poet. What made her good?
Her marvelous control of language, of form, her perception of the way a poem moves, her sense of rhythm. She was a very, very fine poet.
And in terms of her use of language, would that translate to, say, when you were talking, like if you're driving her around and the sort, does she speak in complete sentences? And
well, not always.
No.
In the 70s, I was just, you know, a young professor just appointed, and she was then in her 50s. And she was a figure, a literary figure. So we would talk. We would talk about poems. We would talk about, we would talk a lot about literary nationalism because we were I was of the generation that grew up thinking there was an American literature and then a British literature, but heaven forbid that you say there was a Canadian literature. We talked a lot about our common desire for an acknowledged Canadian writing.
And it's in her time that developed, and that developed as a genre.
That did, in the 70s and 80s, because, of course, there was Margaret Lawrence, who had a great deal to do with this.
What was her relationship with her contemporaries like Lawrence and those after her, like Atwood and Monroe?
Very good. Excellent, really. I describe in the book a time when P.K. is in Victoria and she's wanting to buy a book at Monroe's bookstore. She doesn't have any money, and this is before credit cards. And so she says, well, I know Alan Crawley, who had edited contemporary verse. And Alice Monroe said, who are you? And she said, I write as P.K. Page. And P.K. said, and her face turned pink and then red. And I asked Alice Monroe, you know, you always have to check what your respondent says. You can't take it and write it down in as fact. And Alice said, well, I thought I would faint. Here was a woman whom I'd respected, whose work I'd read, whom I admired, who gave you the sense that it was possible. You know, that's pretty high praise.
Indeed, yeah, especially this week with the news of
yes,
Monroe's
success.
Yes, of the
Nobel Prize.
Yeah. When you read, say, the work of contemporary authors, is the influence of Page there?
Yes, I think it is, in quite a few. You know, think about Marilyn Barring or Patricia Young. You can read, you can sometimes see. And the whole business about the glossa. The glossa was one of the most popular forms written in Canada 2 and 3 years ago. And Jan Zwicky, for example, I think she's had quite an influence, and not just in poetry. I do think her Brazilian journal, for example, had some influence on Michael Ondaatje's Running in the Family. I've never had the chance to ask him this, but I think it did.
Now, you mentioned her time in Brazil. That's when she was married to William Irwin, is that
yes,
right?
Yes, Arthur Irwin, actually.
Arthur, pardon me. Yes. And he was a diplomat, and so he would have been posted there.
Yes, but he was basically a newspaper man, the man who Canadianized Maclean's magazine.
Right.
Maclean's used to be very, very British.
Uh-huh. And I guess she was married to Irwin. The affair with Scott, was that before or after? I guess that was before the marriage?
Yeah. Before, and she was married to Arthur Irwin almost 50 years, 49, I think.
He was like 100 when he died, is that right?
He was 101, I think.
Really, yeah. I guess let's go to the beginning of Paige's life. She was born in England. When did she end up here in Canada?
Well, she was born in England in 1916, and she came home with her father, who was in the Canadian Army, 1919, on a troop ship. So she was about 3 years old.
What was the relationship with her father like?
Well, I think it was a typical 20s relationship. Fathers were very much still Victorian fathers. And children were seen and not heard. But her father was quite remarkable. He encouraged her. He gave her money to go to Montreal and write. He encouraged her to be independent in a variety of different ways. He was a fine father in many ways.
The cover of the book, is that a painting that she did?
No, it's a painting of her. By a maritime painter, a fairly well-known painter.
Miller and Britton?
Yes. I beg, what did you say?
Miller Britton?
Yes, Miller Britton.
Yeah.
And it was lost in a sense that we couldn't find it, and then we did turn it up.
Yeah, and the title of the book, what does that mean, Journey with No Maps?
Well, maybe you're too young to think about it, but for many women, the 20th century was a journey with no maps in a sense that it had never been before. You know, the right to vote, the right to have an independent career, more or less, to be able to support oneself without being married, the possibility later in the century of not having children. All of these things drastically changed women's lives. And Journey with No Maps, for her, I think, meant the whole business of a kind of psychic journey. She recognized that she was taking a journey, that probably other people had taken a similar journey, but for her it was new and she didn't know what was going to happen or where she was going to go. I took the actual words from an essay which she wrote, reflecting on her time in Mexico.
That would have been one of those diplomatic postings that had her in Mexico, is that right?
Yes. She went first to Australia, and then to Brazil, and then to Mexico. And in Mexico, she became very interested in Jung. She'd already been reading Freud, and she was introduced to the works of the Sufi mystic of a sort, Idris Shah, Shah.
Well, what do you think got her interested in religions, and especially the Sufism?
Well, you know, there's a similar pattern in Margaret Avison's life, where she becomes a Christian, where she's converted in her later life.
She never converted, no?
She didn't convert to Sufism, no, because she would argue that no one can claim to be a Sufi. But she became very interested in Sufism, and she began to read Sufi books as they came out. My sense is that she perceived that her life was not as full as she hoped it could be, and she began to look in uniquely metaphysical and religious books for meaning.
I mentioned the affair with Scott. And is that something that you talked to her about?
Very briefly. You recall that I actually wrote Scott's biography,
right.
The Politics of the Imagination, I called it. Scott did not specifically talk about Paige. He was not that sort of a person. But a biographer reads all of the papers, most of the letters, much of the poetry, and comes to certain conclusions. She did speak about Scott briefly if I asked her specific questions, but it wasn't a topic that we pursued at great length.
What was the, I remember an interview you did, I guess last year, with Steve Paikin, and he asked you about the affair.
That was amusing.
It was
an amusing interview.
It was, because he
he made thought it, she was a juicy girl.
and he didn't think much of how he looked.
No, he didn't.
No, so what was the attraction between Paige and Scott?
I guess I saw Othello's visage in his mind, which is not a bad description.
No,
she was very attracted to his intelligence. And he was a charming man. I tried to explain that to Paikin. He was witty. He was amusing. He had a very quick mind. You had to run, really, to catch up with where he was going intellectually.
He's much older than she was, right?
He was 20 years older.
Yeah. There's a great shot. There's a marvelous pictures in the book. The one that I like is, because I've had them on the program over the years, and they're just great guests. Shot here, I guess it was in Sydney, of a lunch, and she's sitting, Paige is sitting and holding court, really, and everyone's
yes,
just enthralled by her, people like Musgrave and Patrick and Lorna.
Yeah.
She had that effect on people, I guess, right?
Yes, and Ted Hughes.
Yeah.
For whom the luncheon was held.
he's sitting next to her and just...
Yes.
He just rapt attention. In terms of what she was like to be with, I mean, near the end of the book, you mentioned that near the end of her life, she, she developed a sort of salty language and the sort, is that right?
Well, I don't think she developed salty language. I think that she was developing a form. I think her mind was breaking down.
I see.
She was lapsing into very salty language, as our brother said, the kind we would have used below decks, because it was an early form, you know, of Alzheimer's.
Uh-huh.
And it was also it's one of the characteristics of the disease as it develops.
Up to that point, though, she was writing regularly?
She was writing, you know, almost up to the end. She was completing a Cullen poem in the November of the year. She died in January of 2010, and this would have been in November, you know, 2009. And the one she'd had finished in August was good enough to be published in Poetry Chicago. So she was very sharp, you know, right up to the end. You know, there's a sense in which Scott was one of the most remarkable men of his generation. He was called a Renaissance man in his times. And there's a sense that P.K. was one of the most remarkable women in her generation. She's certainly had one of the most interesting lives I know of.
Yeah,
for a Canadian.
And I mean, just her output, you think of over 30 books, is that right?
Closer to 40.
Yeah, and did she find the process of writing easy?
I think she worked at it extremely hard. But there's a certain point when you become a pro when it becomes a lot easier. And she was a consummate pro.
Were you the one that got her to use email?
Yes, I was.
Yeah, and so she would email constantly, right?
Yeah, she did, furiously after that.
Yeah, and so did you get to see some of the emails that she wrote others?
Yes, I did.
Yeah, and I've mentioned this already, but she kept in touch with a lot of people like Adam Egoyan and the sort, through email. Do you think that added anything to her later years in terms of keeping in touch?
Oh, I think it enriched her later years. You know, by the 80s, she was finding it difficult to move. She'd had hip surgery. It hadn't worked. It was misery, bone grating against bone. You can't telephone everybody all the time. Fax is expensive. And she didn't have all that much money, you know, in her later years. She was comfortable, but not all that much money. And email was inexpensive, quick, kept everybody in contact with everybody. The computer was a wonderful diversion. She could have never sat and watched TV all day.
Yeah, but she was able to play solitaire and
yes, and she was able to create. She began to write on the computer.
Well, was she scared of death?
I don't think she was scared of death. I think she saw death as a kind of great new adventure. Some transcendental world into which we entered, perhaps in a different form, who knows? But it was something that she looked forward to and wanted to experience.
If we haven't read anything of Paige, other than, say, well, I'm asking this for myself, really, because other than what you, the extracts that you quote in the book, I haven't read anything of hers, really. Is there something that we should read, that we ought to read of hers?
Maybe read Planet Earth. That was the poem that was chosen by the United Nations to put in orbit at the start of the century, at the start of the the new century.
Yeah, and in terms of her other works and books and the sort, is there anything else that we must read?
Well, the easiest one to read is sort of doggerel in a sense, but her little autobiographical book, Hand Luggage, is very easy to read and fun in a way.
Yeah.
But really, I think the book of poems called Planet Earth, with an introduction, is a good place to start. Planet Earth is a separate poem, but just the book of poems called Planet Earth, or the late fine glosses. Hologram is another book, a very remarkable book. Hologram, just Hologram.
Yeah. Did you think she'd have liked this book?
I don't know. I think she would have liked parts of it.
Mm-hmm.
I did not discuss my interpretations of the poems with her in any great detail, but I think she would have approved of them. And I think she would have, on the whole, agreed with my reading of much of her life. You know, biographers like to think that they're right. In fact, there was a lovely cartoon in the thing.
The New Yorker?
The New Yorker, the very thing. It's a little cartoon showing Henry James flat, and it's obviously the psychiatrist's couch. And sitting next to him is, really, it's got to be Leon Adele, because there he is in a Hawaiian shirt. He lived in Hawaii, and a little beret. He used to affect the French beret. And he's scribbling, you know, scribbling on his notebook.
Uh-huh.
And here's the biographer, you know, taking dictation from the master, who, of course, is long dead. And, you know, it's just a lovely cartoon.
Yeah, yeah.
We never know what's really going on in somebody else's head. But we use all of the tools of the biographer, you know, the letters, the diaries, the poems, the essays. And we try our damnedest with external evidence, the letters other people have sent, you know, dates from archives and the rest of it, to put the life in some sort of an order and say it as truthfully as we can.
You've had great success with this book in terms of the awards that it's been up for. The Governor General's Award, I guess, is the next one upcoming. Have you enjoyed the writing of the book, but sort of this valedictory lap afterwards that you're taking?
Well, I really enjoyed writing the book. Biography is very creative. It's like writing a poem or writing a piece of fiction. It's not fiction, you know. All the little pieces in your mosaic has to be fact. But when it all seems to come together in some sort of unity, there's a great pleasure just in the doing of it. The prize giving is another business, because you really don't know how it's going to come out, and you don't know what criteria is being used, and that's always very unsettling. I didn't anticipate all of this. So, you know.
But it must be gratifying, though, isn't it?
Well, yes, it is.
Yeah.
Yes, it is. I guess you sort of cross your fingers and hope for the best.
Yeah.
Don't expect anything but hope for the best.
but I guess the key in all of this is that people get to know Paige a little more than, say, had you not been up for all these prizes.
Yes, I suppose that's true. I was thinking this morning, and this is not quite related to what you were saying, but I was thinking this morning that Paige and I probably got on because I was a Newfoundlander and she had been raised in the Maritimes.
Mm.
And, you know, there's a kind of directness of expression.
Mm-hmm.
And that, in a way, helped us through the process of trying to get the life in order, because PK was a person who never knew when she was where. She didn't believe in dates, you know. She said, well, that's your job, find out the dates and so on. And I would throw up my hands and say, oh, PK!
Yeah.
But being a Maritimer, we have a strong sense of history, you know, and background and all that stuff. And I found writing her life very interesting, because she wasn't just a poet and a writer. She was a kind of representative figure, you know, a kind of contemporary modern.
Uh-huh.
A woman who was growing up and living her life under quite different standards from those that would have been encountered when she was born.
It's a fascinating life and just a great book to read. It's been such a pleasure talking to you today. Good luck with the Governor General's Award.
Well, thank you very much.
The book is called Journey with No Maps. It's published by McGill Queen's University Press. Its author, Sandra Joie, joined me from here in Vancouver. I'm Joseph Plata.